This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with attorney Charlotte Dennett of Vermont, who ran for state attorney general.
She got 6% of the vote and raised a lot of consciousness about what people can do if they want to in terms of holding Bush accountable for the deaths in Iraq.
We'll hear an excerpt of a Georgetown University debate between our own Michael Ratner and Stuart Taylor.
We'll also talk with constitutional lawyer and law professor Michael Tiger.
Tiger has a really good idea of how to make the administration torture officials responsible and pay up. Stay with us.
Attorney Charlotte Dennett of Vermont ran for the state attorney general on the platform that if elected, she will immediately undertake the prosecution of George W. Bush for the unnecessary deaths of Vermont soldiers in Iraq. Vermont has paid the highest price in deaths per capita in the nation. This is the strategy outlined in The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder by author attorney Vincent Bugliosi. The strategy is to establish jurisdiction in the cases for attorneys general in each state and also the approximately 900 district attorneys in the counties of those states. Charlotte was an investigative reporter for 30 years and has been practicing law in Vermont for 11. She helped sue one of the worst polluters of the country, including the DuPont Company.
I wanted to first welcome you to Law and Disorder.
Yes.
And to remind our listeners that you were an investigative reporter for 30 years. You then started practicing law for 11.
Yeah.
Then you did an extraordinary thing. In order to facilitate the movement holding Bush accountable, you ran for Attorney General of Vermont in the last election.
Yeah.
On the promise that you would get Bush indicted for murder for the murder of so many young Vermont men and women.
Yeah.
More people in Vermont than anywhere else in the country.
Well, more per capita.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You didn't make it. You're there in Vermont thinking, what's going to happen next? Are these people ever going to be held accountable for the war, for torture?
Yes.
Charlotte, what happened?
All right. What happened? Look, I never thought I was going to win this race, okay? But I did think that if I could get 20%, that would be a meaningful amount. I knew what the obstacles were. First of all, there was an entrenched incumbent who was a Democrat. And though there had been people, especially in the Burlington area, which is the most populous part of the country, that felt that he was untouchable, that's Attorney General Sorrell, and that he was very popular, I had found out just by being out on the campaign trail that there are a lot of people out there that they didn't even know who the attorney general was, nor did they know what the attorney general did. So I went on that information thinking that I could probably get 20% of the vote. And the fact of the matter is, that's how I felt at the outset. And then, first of all, of course, I had this unique situation where I had Vincent Bugliosi literally hitting his tin cup. Every interview that he went on all over the country, he was being interviewed about his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder.
Bugliosi was a famous and successful prosecutor out in California. I think he prosecuted successfully 106 out of 107 felony trials,
yes,
including 27 murder trials. The most famous of them, Charles Manson. And he wrote a famous book called Helter Skelter, the best-selling true crime book in the history of America. And then he wrote the book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. He couldn't get anybody to publish it. Then when he finally got a publisher, he couldn't get anybody to interview him. We interviewed him on Law and Disorder, and
yeah,
then it got famous after that. We were one of the first, and you teamed up with him because I think he volunteered if you got elected, he was going to help you prosecute Bush, actually.
Yeah.
So now you've teamed up with Bugliosi, and what's your message?
When I started this thing, I knew it would be a real uphill race. And then when he came on board and showed up both at my campaign announcement and also returned later on to help me campaign, I mean, that was a whole new dimension to the race because he was appealing to people all over the country and they were sending in money. It wasn't the amount of money he was hoping for, but for me, you know, to be a brand new candidate with Ultimately, I guess it was over $10,000 that came in, most of them small donations. What it enabled us to do is it enabled us to buy TV ads and radio ads and put in a half-page ad in a couple of papers and so on. So I began to think that, wow, we could do even better. You know, we all thought that. I knew I had two big problems. Number one was the sort of Obama sweep. I knew there would be a lot of people in this election year that would just do that straight party line voting. And I'm quite confident that that's what happened in the election. The other thing that really irritated me, and this is something for us all to understand, is that the incumbent misrepresented continually what I was trying to do and what Vincent Bugliosi would do if he were my special prosecutor. What he claimed is it can't happen in Vermont that if you're going to prosecute war crimes, you have to do it in The Hague. And this is the message that he repeated over and over and over again, making it seem like it was impossible to do in Vermont. Well, he was misrepresenting what we were doing, very consciously, in my humble opinion, because I corrected him. We weren't trying Bush on war crimes, because he's right. War crimes have to be tried in The Hague. What we were doing was proposing to prosecute Bush and others under state murder statutes, criminal statutes. He would not acknowledge that. If he had acknowledged it, then he would have to acknowledge that we could have established jurisdiction, we could have gone forward on this. Because he refused to acknowledge it, it just made it seem hopeless and ridiculous. And I'm afraid that there were a lot of Vermonters that just got that message. We ended up getting 6% of the vote. I got the one consolation is, hey, I got 17,000 votes. But I was shocked. We were all shocked. We thought we would do much better. But, hey, we only had 2 months to do it in, and even though we had good media, you know, we still didn't get out to reach enough people. Enough people didn't know about the campaign. The other thing is that even though there was a huge amount of attention on this one issue, you know, Vermonters got a number of other issues on their plate. They're going to look carefully. They might not necessarily vote for a candidate who's just a single-issue person. And I had other issues, and I tried as hard as I could to get them out. And the biggest one was closing our nuclear plant, which is very dangerous, and had a lot of juicy stuff on that. But the fact of the matter is that it seems that what the Democratic Party's strategy is to constantly misrepresent what prosecutors can do in their separate states. And the reason I say that is because I was just told by a friend, when the Obama administration has been asked if it's going to prosecute, for instance, members of the administration for torture, the person who stepped up and said, no, it can't be done, is our own Senator Patrick Leahy, who's the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And when a friend told me and was very upset to hear this, I said, well, look, though, look how he's couched it. He says, no, you can't, we will not be doing that, war crimes. That's what he said. And so, again, people don't understand this distinction between war crimes and prosecuting under state criminal statutes. So as far as I'm concerned, what people have to do is understand that it can be done by prosecutors. The good news is about what's happened in Texas.
I proudly wear Arrest Cheney First in white letters on a black T-shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hear that they've indicted Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez in Texas on charges related to alleged abuse of prisoners in a federal detention center. And I also heard that Cheney actually owns stock in the detention center. Gonzalez was involved in somehow covering up a crime there.
Now, I don't know if it's a federal detention center. It's private prison companies that run the
right.
Federal detention center. Correct. Yeah. There's a case where you've got a brave prosecutor who was willing to bring an indictment before a grand jury. And now the question is, what's the judge going to do? And a lot of people are predicting that somehow they're going to squash this. This is something that certainly Bugliosi anticipated. He said, look, there will be no difficulty bringing indictments. It's what happened after you bring the indictment. And you know, the Bush people will come up with all sorts of legal theories. They'll cook them up if they have to prevent it from going forward.
Let's fast forward.
Yeah, sure.
And get out of Texas for a second.
Sure.
What can people like ourselves
yeah.
do now that we see the signals coming from the incoming Democratic administration that there's going to be no accountability for the war crimes and torture. What do you think we should do next?
I think you should not roll over on that. What has to happen is that there has to be a movement that helps, maybe a centralized location where people can go to and understand how to fight this. And I think that that's probably going to happen. I've been recovering from a dreadful cold, still not quite over it. But in any event, this week is the week where I'm really starting to find out, you know, what other people are doing, whether they're just going to be discouraged by this message that's coming out of the leadership of the Democratic Party. I mean, there are Americans who feel like we just need to move on. That's a very powerful movement. But I also think that the one reason why they're not touching it is because the Democratic Party let some of it happen. This is one of the theories behind why impeachment never happened, was because they had been briefed about the torture and they went along with it, you know, rather than get their dirty laundry even dirtier, they would just, and I'm talking about the Democratic leadership, would just as soon move on. I certainly feel it's incumbent on us to say, wait a minute, if we just keep letting this happen, then what kind of society are we going to encourage or allow? And are we just marching closer to Germany? We all hope now that with Obama's election that we've got some breathing room. But we know who Obama was before he took the White House, and we do know that he has certain values, and we do know that he was the most progressive member of the Senate. Of course, once this person gets into the White House, then what kind of pressures are coming on him by very powerful people? What I've been hearing over and over again is that we, the grassroots, are the people that put him in there, and that he needs to hear from us, and that we're not going to walk away from certain issues, and one of them is to send a very powerful message to him as well, that the American people simply will not tolerate the kind of lawlessness that swept through Washington during the last 8 years of the Bush administration, and that we are demanding that there has got to be some kind of accountability for these people. So there has to be a movement against this attitude of we just want peace and harmony and we just want to move on.
What are your plans along those lines now?
I mean, it was only 2 months that I worked on this campaign. I'm certainly not going to walk away from it. I'll probably do some writing, try to give some analysis, and maybe certainly a roadmap of where people who care about this issue.
Charlotte Dennett, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We congratulate you in your fight up there in Vermont. You know, you can win without winning.
Yeah.
And we think you did that. We very much like talking with you, and we wish you every success now that you're no longer campaigning for Attorney General, but still causing trouble.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me on your show. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Thanks, Charlotte. We go now to hear an excerpt from a debate between our own Michael Ratner and Stuart Taylor at Georgetown University, moderated by David Vladek. Stuart Taylor is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institute and a columnist for the National Journal and contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. The event was titled, On War Crimes and Torture, Should High Government Officials Be Investigated and Prosecuted? The issues of investigation and prosecution of war crimes and torture come to the forefront as the Bush administration draws to a close. Let's have a listen.
You're going to hear a lot of reasons why we can't do prosecution. Just remember that to not do an investigation and prosecution is to give impunity. And think about the message that impunity sends, not just to this government, to every precinct in this country, to every other country in the world, that you could torture in the, quote, name of national security, so can we. We don't want to send a message of impunity. You're going to also hear, well, they have legal defenses. And we can talk specifically as we get into what their legal defenses are. Because let me say, from the very first, these guys had one thing on their mind. They wanted to abuse people coerce them, torture them, but they were very worried about the two statutes that we have on our books here, the anti-torture statute and the war crime statute. And they had to figure out a way to get around them. And that's where they already started this program even before they had their ways around them, but that's where you get this flurry of memos to try and figure out what they call a golden shield, what I would call really fool's gold. I don't think it works. I think the defenses will do them no good. But it's not really a question for Stewart or I to decide here. It's a question when they go before a jury, for a jury to decide, were these people acting in good faith or bad faith? Was it reasonable? Were these defenses reasonable? But one thing I can promise you, if there is no investigation and prosecution here, and if there are pardons, I can promise you that, as I've already tried to do in Germany and France, there will be cases in Europe brought against what I call the torture conspirators, and they will be pursued everywhere they go. Because one way that Europe will definitely pursue them is if they know they're pardoned in this country. Another thing you'll hear is this: that this will divide the country. It's the wrong time to do it. You know, in my view, it's not a reason for leaving in place a precedent that says the president, when he wants to, can engage in torture. Already, the fact that there is a division of some sort on this in the country means that the next time this comes up, we will again get a torture regime. Our job really is to close that divide in the country, and Obama can do a lot to do it. You know, when I heard the speech that he gave on race, it was like one of the most incredible speeches I've ever heard in probably the last 20 years. He could give that kind of speech on abuse and torture and say, so that we never do this again, I'm going to stop criminal investigations. One thing you'll also hear is, well, Michael, it's unreal. They say you'll never get it. You know, you'll certainly never get it unless you demand it. That I can guarantee you. And I can also remember, you know, it took 35 years to get Pinochet. You know, memory is long on this kind of stuff. And it's only taken us 7 years to get the first people, not out yet, but a judge, federal judge, ordering them out. So I'm not pessimistic about this. And really, the worst thing I think I hear on this is that, Michael, we don't want you looking backward. Why should we look backward? Why don't we look forward and ban torture from the future? Well, if you get my point here, when you go after people, when you criminally investigate them, you're not looking backward. You're looking forward. You're making sure that in the future, we're not going to have torture. It's not about looking backward. It's called deterrence. And we don't have a problem generally in this country with the idea that criminal law is to deter other people from engaging in criminal law. That's the argument. I'm going to just close with a quote by General Taguba. General Taguba was one of the investigators who was by the Bush administration to look into the Iraq Abu Ghraib scandal. And what he said was, after he left the administration, after his Taguba report, he said, "The commander-in-chief and those under him authorized the systemic regime of torture. There is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account." And that is the only question that remains to be answered. And that's really up to all of us.
I agree with a great deal of Michael's eloquent presentation, except for the most important part for our purposes today, which is his view that high government officials should be prosecuted and investigated first, of course. My answer is they should not be, based on what we know, and my prediction is that they will not be, which I had hoped would sound like a bold prediction in this room until Senator Leahy made the same prediction quite confidently in the paper. Senator Leahy not being one of the more conservative members of the Senate. I think that, contrary to Michael's view, just to respond quickly, prosecutions are not the only way to prevent these kind of abuses from happening again. I think the best way is to adopt new, more enlightened policies and laws. Indeed, the torture program has stopped, as far as I know. I'm not aware of any reports of anything that could be called torture by anyone in the United States government in several years. I'm not sure when it stopped, and maybe Michael knows something I don't know, but I think it stopped. Public opinion, public exposure did that. As for impunity, well, the people who are being called war criminals by Michael and others I think, do not feel that they acted with impunity. I'm not sure you need to put them in prison to provide a deterrent for people to do improper things. But let me get to my, and I'll touch on pardons later if we get to questions, but first I'm going to give four basic reasons why I think we shouldn't have prosecutions. First, as Michael forecast, I do think that such prosecutions would tear the country apart, would blow up President-elect Obama's hopes of lifting us out of our multiple crises, but I don't ask you to take my word for it. Listen to what Barack Obama said in an interview in April. I'm quoting, "We need to distinguish between really dumb policies and policies that rise to the level of criminal activity." He went on to say, "I would not want my first term consumed by what was perceived on the part of Republicans as a partisan witch hunt, because I think we've got too many problems to solve." Obviously, I don't think he was saying if we've got a cold case that somebody committed illegal torture, we should ignore it, but I think we should, you know, I think he was saying if we're making debatable cases, it's going to be counterproductive. Second, while I deplore the brutal interrogation methods that were approved at high levels, and while some detainees were certainly tortured in the usual meaning of that word, there's no evidence that high-level officials acted with criminal intent. In this regard, I'm reminded of a line attributed to Talleyrand, I think, "It was worse than a crime. It was a blunder." The main reason that I think there was no criminal intent is that, as Michael also forecast, they were relying in good faith on the advice of legal counsel, especially the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Now, this isn't the same thing as a corporation hiring a fancy New York law firm and paying them $9,000 an hour to give them a carte blanche to do what they want. This is the institution that prosecutes crimes, federal crimes in this country, and the only institution that prosecutes federal crimes. It would be illegal, I think, and unconscionable for the same Justice Department that authoritatively advised people that waterboarding and the like, for example, within careful limits, did not violate the criminal law, to turn around, same Justice Department, say, come to think of it, it did violate the criminal law now that the administration's changed, so we're going to prosecute you. Now, reliance on advice of counsel is no defense if the client's acting in bad faith, but briefly, all of the methods approved at high levels in this matter have been approved not only by the gonzo executive imperialist John Yoo, whose famous 2002 August memo I was one of the earlier denouncers of is indefensible. Indeed, under that memo, you could take 500 Guantanamo detainees down to the beach and behead them one by one, saying, we're going to keep doing this until you start talking. That is not what was done. And a lot of lawyers in the executive branch, more respectable and more mainstream than John Yoo, after his memo was withdrawn, approved all of the techniques that were approved at high levels as a matter of policy, including waterboarding. Now, maybe they were wrong about that. These were serious lawyers, and the executive branch officials who relied on them were entitled to rely on them. And I can elaborate later on why waterboarding, which sure does seem like torture in the lay sense, could be deemed not necessarily a violation of the very narrowly drafted torture statute. So that's law. But third, even if a technical case could be made for prosecuting high officials, it would be unwise and unwarranted as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, both for the reasons noted above and because these officials, hate them or not, were honorably motivated. They were not doing this out of sadism. They were not doing it to terrorize a population or maintain themselves in power. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, among others, signed off on these techniques without protesting them. They were all doing it because they were desperately afraid, for good reason, that unless they could extract the secrets of Al-Qaeda terrorists such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, many more American lives would be lost, and they would be to blame because they shrank from doing what they were advised they could legally do. Indeed, they feared that this building and the rest of downtown Washington and or New York would be obliterated by nuclear devices or depopulated by biological warfare if they didn't get the secrets. The danger of that happening eventually remains very high, although we maybe become a little bit numb to it. Fourth, the approach that Michael advocates, in my opinion, would have the wrong kind of deterrence. Yes, it might deter people from torturing, but it also would deter them from doing some tough things that need to be done. And it would make it hard to get good people into the toughest jobs. It would be hard for President Obama to get good people into the toughest jobs. I wonder, for example, whether he'll have trouble finding a first-rate person to be the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. Here's what a woman who would be an outstanding Obama appointment said to me, in essence. As a reasonable person, I would approve the legality of actions that the human rights groups are going to call criminal, even though they aren't. There are life and death decisions that have to be made instantaneously. Who would want to have to spend years defending herself from charges of being a war criminal? Now, Michael mentions that they better be careful about vacationing in Europe. Well, he's right. They better be careful, because they could well be prosecuted there. And the last point I might make before stopping is a little bit of a hypothetical question. Suppose that your child were kidnapped and held for ransom by two evil men. Suppose they threatened to kill your child unless ransom was paid by 5 p.m. Suppose further that you took the ransom to a 3 p.m. rendezvous with one of the men. The police were following you. They grabbed him. For 2 hours, they try everything they can try, sweet talk, harsh talk, good cop, bad cop. They invite you to stay there, and you make a plea, a passionate plea, please, my child, you kill my child at 5 p.m. if you don't tell us where she is. Man is silent. Man is laughing. 1 hour from when your hidden child is to be murdered. The police captain starts beating and kicking the suspect while saying, I'm going to beat you to death if you don't talk. Would you tell the captain to stop? Think about it.
I trust you'd like a moment to respond.
Sure. I think we can go point by point and just do a couple of the points, Stuart.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this question of what Obama thinks and tearing the country apart and what the Democrats think is, while it's out there and of some importance, that if I guided my actions by that, I wouldn't be litigating any cases. My goal is to change that attitude and to make it one in which they understand that what has happened here is we have gone off the fundamental principle, really, of a democracy and of law, which is that there's a fundamental right to be free from torture, and that we're a government of laws and not of men where people make the laws. And if they don't understand at this point that that's as important, or maybe more important, or maybe it's worth taking some risk with the population to say, we have to stand for these principles and begin an investigation of people who violated those, then I hope in the next couple of years to make them understand that. That's the first point. The second one on the memos, I just think the memos are garbage, and I don't think they're going to be any defense. And I think that every time it gets raised as this golden shield, it's completely absurd. I mean, one is a lot of the conduct happened before the memos. There were people in secret CIA sites being abused, tortured, war crimes being committed, whatever, before August 1st, 2002, and being badly brutalized before the, quote, U memo came out. So you have a problem because there's prior. Secondly, you have a problem in places like Iraq, which had the Fourth Geneva Convention applicable to it, maybe even still today, but certainly through Abu Ghraib and all of the incidents that happened in Iraq, when the so-called Rumsfeld techniques, the 15, 18 torture techniques, in the case 35 and then reduced that went to Iraq, were brought over there, and then they were under the Fourth Convention, and there's no memos at all about the Fourth Convention and the grave breach provision of the Fourth Convention. So there's those technical things. But the bigger thing is what happened here, and what if you read Philip Sands, if you read Jane Mayer, if you read really what happened with OLC here, they were not giving independent counsel. They were shaping their memos essentially around the policy. And even Jack Goldsmith says that in his book when he was at OLC, that they were shaping the memos to fit a policy that had already been determined. And they weren't really honest brokers in terms of the law. The best way to say it, they were in cahoots with these guys. They were in cahoots with Addington and Cheney and said, let's figure out, they went to them, let's figure out a way we can abuse people, let's figure out a way we can torture people, but really, let's figure out a way to avoid the war crime statute, let's figure out a way to avoid the anti-torture statute, and give us memos so that we can use these as a shield so we can encourage lower-level people to engage in them. Now, it may be that lower-level people have a defense with this, but certainly the guys who I consider
really a conspiracy or aiders and abettors and who set this whole program up. This is not independent arm's length advice. And that came out as you look through the people who took that office after you left, particularly Bradbury, who came in last, and they put him on a temporary appointment for a month while they made sure. And then he wrote a memo that not just said waterboarding is okay, but that waterboarding, even combined with other techniques, is okay. So you have people who are completely under the thumb of the administration and not acting under the OLC. You know, I think the issue is it should get to a jury, but I don't think that a good faith defense is going to be upheld. What you want in a deterrence thing is, you know, when you look at the war crime statute or you look at a common Article 3 or the Geneva Conventions or the torture statute, the argument was that, well, it's not precisely defined. How do you tell what it is? And really what it is, it's not precisely defined for a reason. Humane treatment is not precisely defined. It's defined in cases and by the ICRC, et cetera, but they don't want people going close to the line. And what you had here was an administration that twisted the law and not just went close to the line, but then way over the line.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Talk now with one of the great trial lawyers in the United States, Michael Tiger. He's a professor of law at the University of Texas. He's written the only book in the English language on law and the rise of capitalism, and he was most recently defending attorney Lynn Stewart on charges of conspiring to materially aid terrorists here in New York City. Michael Tiger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Sure, and you're going to edit this, right, and all that? All right.
We got plenty of time, so...
I looked back. Hugo Grocer in 1608 wrote, "The delusion is as old as it is detestable, with which many men, especially those who by their wealth and power exercise the greatest influence, persuade themselves, or as I rather believe, try to persuade themselves, that justice and injustice are distinguished the one from the other, not by their own nature, but in some fashion merely by the opinion and custom of mankind. Those men therefore think that both the laws and the semblance of equity were devised for the sole purpose of repressing the dissensions and rebellions of those persons born in a subordinate position, affirming meanwhile that they themselves, being placed in a high position, ought to dispense all justice in accordance with their own good pleasure, and that their pleasure ought to be bounded only by their own view of what is expedient." Now, that is exactly 400 years ago. So, and then another, John Mage, my friend John Mage and I.
You're still friends with Mage?
Of course, yes. Well,
yes.
On February 27, 1933, the German building, the Reichstag, was set on fire. This terrorist act became the pretext for establishing special courts, defining certain groups of people as not having any rights, failed violations of rights to be protected against unreasonable search and seizure, and all the rest of the things we've come to identify with the Nazi regime. And the amazing thing was that most of the parliamentarians were silent in the face of this onslaught. Most of the lawyers stood by, and most of the judges were complicit in it. as we look back at these 8 years, the systematic breaking down of all barriers against government intrusion into the private lives of people. We have the creation of this class of persons, alien enemy combatants and so on, who are thought to be utterly rightless, both as to whether they can be detained, the conditions of their detention, and the manner in which they can be held and interrogated. While all this is happening, we have legal fictions like the vice president saying that he's neither a member of the executive nor the legislative branch, and therefore rather than being subject to the rules of both is subject to the rules of neither. We have a Justice Department staffed increasingly with people whose only qualification is their asserted ideological purity. I think they're just going to call it the department now and end all the people. But it is still the department that calls itself justice. We have two, at least, aggressive wars, all done to the tune of the most massive federal deficits in history, financed by these deficits and accompanied by the largest transfer of wealth from the poor and the working class to the already wealthy. That, in turn, coupled with the dismantling of any regulatory barriers to how greed and avarice are to operate, with consequences with which we are all now distressingly familiar. So that is, in a few words, where we are. And it is the lack of any significant organized resistance from legislators, and with some few bright exceptions, judges and lawyers, that define for us, it seems to me, the task that lies ahead. And I am talking now to lawyers who know very well how difficult it was to get people interested in combating this sort of activity. I've started looking over, I know all of us have, the proposals of the new administration about Department of Justice and the Attorney General and the kinds of appointments that are going to be made. I don't get a great deal of comfort from that. Eric Holder is a good lawyer. Eric Holder was also the lawyer who was on a very small group of people who decided that in the Clinton administration, that even though they had all the evidence, that they would not prosecute Augusto Pinochet for murdering Orlando Letelier, even though the FBI had made the case.
That's interesting.
We met in the department several times because, you know, Sam Buffone, my former partner, and I have represented the Letelier family and tried to get that done. I had worked with the prosecution team on the London extradition. Sam and I had worked with Juan Garces. We were close to that.
Tell us briefly who Letelier was and how he was murdered.
Yes. Orlando Letelier was a foreign minister in the government of Salvador Allende. When Allende was overthrown and murdered by the military junta, Orlando was first jailed, and then he lived in exile. On September 21st, 1976, a Chilean secret agent, aided by some Cuban gusanos that he had recruited, killed Orlando Letelier by exploding a bomb in the car that he was driving on the streets of Washington, an event that also killed his assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, and injured her husband, Michael Moffitt. My partner, Sam Buffone, and I got a judgment against the Chilean government for that assassination, which was eventually paid. And then, as most people remember, there was a criminal case filed in Spain against Pinochet, and eventually the House of Lords held that he was not indeed immune and could be extradited back to Spain. He'd gone to London for medical treatment. And then the then Home Secretary, Jack Straw, decided, no, that he could go back to Chile. So that in brief is it. But the American Justice Department had the evidence and could have prosecuted Pinochet in this country for that murder. Where do I come out with all of this? I think that the left should know by now that regardless of who is in the administration, we cannot trust the government to do our business for us.
An important statement, Michael. Really important.
And that what we need to demand from the Obama Justice Department is they start making the process of litigation to get compensation for the victims of these horrors. And by that I mean, first, that they will not interpose the so-called political question barrier to decision. As you may know, when a group of students and I sued Henry Kissinger for his complicity in the assassination of Chilean General Schneider and tortures and disappearances, The D.C. Circuit in the person of Judge Sentell held that, well, that's a political question. We couldn't possibly go into that. I don't know why murder is a political question if you aided and abetted it, but there you are. That same Judge Sentell held that, of course, it's not a political question if you want to sue about Darfur in American courts. That even though that has even less connection to the forum, that's not a problem. Well, that political question objection, that is that the court shouldn't consider it, that can't be interposed. Second, the administration, this new administration, should start recognizing that in this litigation, the discovery process is going to uncover these wrongs, and they should not impose frivolous and captious resistance to discovery on the grounds of purported national security.
National security, what you mean by that, of course, is state secrets as well would be encompassed by that?
Yes. I don't like to sound like old Methuselah here, but way back when, back in the volume 345 of the United States Reports, you'll find a case about a journalist named Quentin Reynolds who took a ride on an Air Force plane that crashed, and his widow sued under the Federal Tort Claims Act, saying that she thought that maybe there had been some negligence. And the United States successfully convinced the Supreme Court that to disclose why that plane might have crashed involved state secrets and that she should not be able to sue. The Supreme Court did say in passing that judicial control over the evidence in the case should not be abandoned to the caprice of the executive branch. But despite those noble words, they put Mrs. Reynolds out of court. 60 years later, the maintenance file on that airplane was unsealed. And it turned out it was a routine maintenance error that had caused the crash.
I think, I think it's really significant to raise that case. Of course, it's been my bugaboo for years, and every case I've brought has been the Reynolds case and the misreading of it, of course. But underneath it, it didn't even have any merit.
Right. Well, exactly. And now, of course, there's a law firm attempted to have it reopened, filed papers in
That's
the Supreme
fine.
Court.
I didn't know
didn't
that.
Work.
But what's interesting also is, it's what your point is about stopping these, which I think is great. I mean, all of the cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought, other organizations in the recent so-called post-9/11 have been held up primarily by what you're calling a national security state secrets exemption.
Well, exactly. And because what we understand now from Reynolds, what we understand from Wenho Lee, what we understand from case after case is that behind the curtain of state secrets, national security, there is illegality and mendacity.
You know, we're not even allowed to talk about the torture and abuse that happened to our clients at Guantanamo. That's all national security.
I understand that contention is being made. And this, is what has happened. People wonder, why is it that the world opinion of the United States of America has declined precipitously for the past 8 years and now is at an all-time low? I understand that the new administration is going to be very busy. So what's wrong with letting the market call out legal services and the lawyers could expect to be paid by fee-shifting and contingent fee arrangements by processing these lawsuits?
You know what I love about it? One of the that I write about a lot, of course, is, going into criminal investigations and everything. But what this does also is this sends the message exactly that you need to send. And it's not looking backward. It's looking forward. You torture somebody, you do this kind of conduct, and you will be at the end of a lawsuit and damages will be recovered against you. Very important.
Let's look. How many years did it take? Almost 20. For any kind of proposed criminal accountability for Pinochet. In the wake of the Second World War, large numbers of French officials who had been Nazi collaborators, but France didn't get around to passing a criminal statute about it until 1964, and the first case wasn't tried until the 1980s. So criminal sanctions, when there's been a regime change, is always chancy. But we know a whole lot of lawyers who are willing to take up the challenge. And this, after all, is the way that the tort system, that's the way we enforce rules about safe products. It's the way that we enforce rules about the toxic substances that poison people. It's the way, at least until the Republican Congress got hold of the securities laws, that we deal with the kleptocracy that rules Wall Street. It's kind of a tested method. So well tested, as a matter of fact, that, you know, there's this wonderful case, Marbury versus Madison. We remember it.
1803.
Yes, we remember it because Chief Justice Marshall said that the Supreme Court could decide a statute was unconstitutional. That was the second half of the case. In the first half of the case, he went on at great length and caused Thomas Jefferson great irritation by saying that, of course, Marbury had a right to his commission. But even if you could say he didn't, he had a right to litigate about whether he had a right to his commission, and that only the gravest of considerations could strip the system of justice of its obligation to provide him a remedy.
If you take a look at this with a historical perspective, this country has come quite a long way in 200 years. I mean, the social struggles that culminated in the Constitution, and particularly the Bill of Rights, you don't have those anymore. You had 30 years of Reagan and people like Reagan, like Clinton, and the social struggles have subsided to such an extent, I think, that you had this all culminate with the illegalities of the Cheney-Bush administration. It may take some years to get it back and some struggles to get it back. I don't think it's going to come automatically on January 20th when Obama takes office.
Well, I'm sure that it's not going to come automatically. What we've seen since Reagan was inaugurated is, first of all, a wholesale change in the structure, the personnel of the federal judiciary, and a set of attitudes about social responsibility that, you know, exists in a large part of the legal profession, and that needs to be corrected.
Yeah.
I will say this. In the last several weeks, I have had dinner with five United States Court of Appeals judges, each of them appointed by Reagan, Bush 1, or Bush 2.
Yeah. Hmm?
So far as I could tell, they'd all voted for Obama.
That's good.
How do you explain that?
Well, as a very conservative United States Court of Appeals judge remarked, this administration has shown such utter disrespect for the very idea of the rule of law. And he topped it off by saying that John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as a running mate showed it was a profound insult to any rational view of the democratic process. I'm of a certain age, you know, kind of well along in the seventh decade of life here, and it's a little frustrating to see how much work there is to do. And I think back, however, 20 years, I was in South Africa during the apartheid period, and here was a government that was the first morning I woke up in Johannesburg. The police trucks were out seizing all the copies of the newspaper that had dared to print a picture of a cop hitting somebody. And yet in 1990, Mandela gets out. Albie Sachs said, you know, all revolutions are impossible until they happen. Then they become inevitable. We understand that we can talk about a foreclosure crisis for people that have houses, but all over the around the world are people that didn't have houses to start with. That the population of the world as a whole has still, in one way or another, been holding on to these ideas that have fallen into disrepair in our own country, and that we are part of a struggle. We do have a theory of history, and that theory gives us some guidance as to a direction that we ought to go.
Break that down for us, Michael. In what direction do you think we ought to go?
The struggles today in the third world need to be taken account of more than perhaps we do. Here we are on the radio talking about the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment and so forth and so on. I was in Berlin at a conference in September 2006 where a bunch of us were supposed to answer questions sent in from around the world. And one of the questions was, how much liberty would you trade for some more security? And we had, there was a guy from a Muslim country answered it, and he said, you know, this question must have been sent in by a Westerner.
No kidding.
Because we don't have either one. And therefore, we really can't play that game. And that reminds us that the struggle for the sort of first-generation bourgeois democratic rights today is seen as only a limited part of what has to go on. And that is the economic and social rights, rights with respect to the environment. These, the struggle, the worldwide struggle, focuses on a much broader agenda than some folks have about our own country. And we won't achieve much, it seems to me, unless we see that. I can give you just a, I know you're talking to a lot of people, let me give you just a corner of it.
Yeah, we'd like today, that, please.
Today, the major oil companies control only 10% of the world's proven oil reserves. More than 70% are controlled by national oil companies, and we know where those nations are, principally in the Middle East. Of course, there's oil in Venezuela, but it's been demonstrated that Venezuela has probably passed its peak in terms of production. So the conflict in the Middle East relates to the conflict for fossil fuels. And that's just, that's only a small part of what's happening in the world. But the attempt of the Bush-Cheney administration to prop up regimes, these corrupt regimes in all of the countries in the Middle East, and particularly around the Caspian Sea of late, is part of their economic plan as well as a plan about foreign and military policy. And this, in turn, takes us back, if you recall, to the 1950s, when Premier Mossadegh in Iran was overthrown by the British and American oil interests because he wanted to promote more equitable distribution and Iran's control of its own petroleum resources. Ultimately, we can draw a line here. When we say the word terrorist, and when we look at the ethnicity of the vast majority of people being held as supposed terrorists or prosecuted for terrorism offenses, we can see that their aspirations relate to, in some measure, what they see as the liberation of their countries from Western dominance. And those countries are in turn the ones where these large quantities of hydrocarbons are located. Our struggle, while it's a good idea to be fighting around issues of detention and rendition and torture and the rights of Americans, also has to be a struggle around issues of foreign and military policy. And so far, the noises from the Obama administration about commitment of troops in the so-called military struggle against terrorism have not been terribly encouraging.
Michael Tiger, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.